genetic databases, intellectual property and individual privacy. This is a talk given to the BCS Edinburgh branch on Wednesday the 20th of February 2008 by Professor Graham Laurie of the University of Edinburgh. This recording is copyright BCS 2008.
As Alison sort of indicated, I'm a lawyer. But my real passion all the way through my academic career has been privacy. And one of the things about being a lawyer that I've always avoided is sort of technical hard law, such as, you know, the meaning of Section 486 of the Companies Act really doesn't interest me. My area of interest is really at the interfaces of law, ethics, science and technology. And our centre based in the law school there, Script, actually brings together those interests very, very nicely. But nonetheless, sort of fundamentally, I am a lawyer. And I'm going to start by offering you two promises for my talk this evening. There will be very little law, but because I'm not a technical person, there will be even less technicalities. Rather, what I want to explore with you are some of my personal experiences of working on what is effectively a social experiment. There are examples around the world, populations and notions of identity, and with that come quite serious concerns about privacy, but also exploitation of the very valuable resources that are being developed as a result of this science. So I want to sort of look at the contours in the context of what's happening in the UK, more specifically in the context of the UK Biobank project, because as Alison's indicated, I'm the chair of their Ethics and Governance Council, and I'll explain what role we have there. But in terms of any more technicalities, I promise there will be no more PowerPoint effects. Okay, so I think in order to engage on where we are, we have to sort of grasp some of the background. And the background really is the genome project of genetic data banking. As I've indicated, there are many examples around the world of enormous data banks being set up, focusing very much on populations or focusing very much on disease traits. And a common theme to many of them, to most of them, is the desire to say, well, now that we understand what the human genome is made up of and what its sequences actually are, can we better understand the relationship between genetics and environment, the interaction between gene and environment? And what that means is that the common motivator for these projects, for these enormous databases, is the quest both for genotype, an understanding of the genetics and the genomes themselves, but also phenotype, the way in which the genetics and the genome actually expresses itself in the human organism. And what that comes down to from the point of view of law and ethics is a quest for data. And where there's a concern is the fact that may be and is often a quest for personal data. Data that relates to individuals or from which individuals can be identified. And in the context of these population databases, what we see are quests for DNA, other forms of biological samples, including blood, but also urine or even tissue, lengthy and detailed accounts of family history, and also a request for ongoing access to individuals' medical records throughout their entire life. So while you can carry out the genotypic analysis on any samples that are submitted today, what you want to work out ultimately is what happens to that person through the later stages of their life or with respect to other family members in order to understand the extent to which genetics is in play and or the extent to which environment is having some sort of effect. And it's really distinction to the quest for personal data that we also have effectively a quest for new knowledge. But with new knowledge, increasingly, particularly in this, comes the realization that there may well be intellectual property claims and the promotion of property. And it's really that tension that I want to explore with you this evening. And a final point, really, to sort of emphasize the background is we have to sort of appreciate and the social and political climate in which we find ourselves. Almost every day you find in the newspapers and other media reference to these sorts of endeavours, which, as we were having a conversation with Alison early on, very often it gets mixed up with concerns about surveillance, concerns about lost government tapes or discs, etc. And there's very little opportunity, or I would argue not enough opportunity, for fora such as this, where we can actually get our facts straight and explore what the actual issues are and sort of deal with the realities. But one of the realities that the UK Biobank project is dealing with is the fact that there is considerable political and social tension surrounding these sorts of projects. I just want to give you some comparisons in terms of what we are and are not talking about. Most of you may well have heard already of the DECODE project, the endeavour to effectively sort of map the Icelandic genomic data, linking it to familial and genotypic data with respect to almost the entire population of 250,000 Icelandic people. That project attracted considerable criticism for a number of reasons. One of them was the fact that they went for what's called an opt-out system, i.e. the expectation was that all members of the population would be involved and access would be granted to relevant information unless they chose to opt out from it. And the concern there from an ethical perspective is that, well, that's not necessarily respecting individuals' wishes because they may not actually know that there's something to opt out of. So from the privacy point of view, the people's privacy may well be invaded when they are not in a position necessarily to know something or to do something about it. But from the exploitation point of view, from the commercialization point of view, the other concern was that effectively this project in Iceland was being run by one body, DECODE, and that body had entered an exclusive license to allow access to the information to Roche Pharmaceuticals, meaning that Roche ultimately would have complete control over the commercialization and exploitation of any new knowledge generated from these databases. That project has not got off the ground. Indeed, despite the fact that the Icelandic Parliament passed a law saying this is the basis upon which we're going to proceed, it was ruled to be unconstitutional in the Constitutional Court because it did not sufficiently respect the privacy rights of individual Icelandic people, which are in effect the same privacy rights that we enjoy as European citizens around the European Economic Area. So that's one way not to do it, I would suggest. Two examples that we have here in the UK are UK Biobank and Generation Scotland. These are both up and running now. They've had many years of preparation, I would say since the last few years of the last century, but they're very complementary. They're quite different in their approach. So, UK Biobank is effectively looking to recruit 500,000 healthy adults aged 40 and 69. These are individuals who are not necessarily related, and what Biobank wants to do is to track their, as I've indicated, the relationship between genes and environment in the onset of diseases in later life. And they are recruiting all around the country, and therefore the potential access is over 60 million, but what they need to recruit is 500,000. As far as Scotland's concerned, they've already opened recruitment centres in Glasgow and in Edinburgh, and apparently one in Edinburgh is actually doing rather well. Indeed, some of you may already have received your invitations to participate in UK Biobank. Generation Scotland is slightly different. First of all, it's funded differently. It's effectively a consortium of the main medical schools around Scotland, whereas UK Biobank is funded by the Wellcome Trust and the MRC with some input from the Department of Health. But Generation Scotland is actually focusing on Scottish families, and their ideal aim is to recruit families with three or more sibling pairs in order to understand better how disease is spread in families. And their focus is going to be very much on, in the first instance, on diseases that affect Scotland, such as heart disease, stroke, mental illness, etc. Now, because of the power of recruiting families as opposed to individuals with UK Biobank, their aim and their expectation is they only have to recruit 50,000 in the first instance in order to have the same sort of statistical power, they feel, for their database compared to UK Biobank's 500,000 of unrelated individuals. But what's common to both of these, as you can see on the slide, is that they are an opt-in system. It's very different to what happened in Iceland. Here, it's an entirely voluntary process. And indeed, both of them adopted the same approach towards the ethical, legal, and governance issues that I want to talk to you about this evening. But what I'm going to do is focus on the UK Biobank example. I've been involved in both, and we can talk about both, but we need to sort of just use one example. I would suggest to you that what's actually been going on and is going on with the governance of UK Biobank and Generation Scotland is actually what I call an ethics plus approach, or a governance plus approach. And what I mean by that is they have to conform with all the legal and ethical requirements that any other research project, genetic or otherwise, involving human beings would have to respect. And yet what they've done is they've gone beyond what's required in terms of the governance that actually applies to the individual project. Why? Well, there's a number of reasons. First of all, as I've indicated already, there have been public concerns stemming in large part from what happened in Alderhay and Bristol many years ago in terms of retention of organs, and a lot of the debate, as I've suggested as well, can get mixed up with concerns that come from actually unrelated fields. But what does seem to have happened is a resultant undermining of public trust in research generally, in medical research in particular, in respect of what might happen to information or samples that are actually provided. And also in the context of UK Biobank, the funders Wellcome Trust and the MRC felt that just the sheer scale of this project, which is now one of the largest in the world, merited some closer attention in terms of how it was going to be run and operated over the long term. So what happened was, at the same time as they were developing the scientific protocol as to how exactly they were going to operate UK Biobank as a scientific project, they developed what's called the Ethics and Governance Framework. This is a document which effectively lays out the parameters of the responsibilities of UK Biobank to its participants, to the research community, and to society more broadly. And as part of that Ethics and Governance Framework, it provides that there should be the establishment of an independent Ethics and Governance Council to oversee UK Biobank. And it's that Ethics and Governance Council of which I am currently the chair. I'd like to explore with you what that actually involves. In terms of the setup and the relationships, this diagram, I think, sums it up rather well. So as I've indicated here in the top right, the funders are in large part the Medical Research Council and the Wellcome Trust, with input from various other bodies, including the Scottish Executive. And UK Biobank has been set up as a UK charitable company, not for profit necessarily. And it involves collaboration between 22 different universities through 6 regional collaborating centres. And the recruitment process that started last year effectively is to target different cities around the country and to reach certain numbers before moving on. So they started in Manchester, they moved to Oxford, they came to Glasgow, they're in Edinburgh, they're opening in Cardiff, etc., etc. Funds come from the funders down to UK Biobank. I think it's £64 million that they're currently estimating it's going to cost. Of course, Biobank is accountable to the funders. But to the side of this is Governance Council, indicating its independence. The Ethics and Governance Council, in return, is accountable to the funders who actually fund it. But the overarching obligation of the Ethics and Governance Council is to oversee and advise UK Biobank, and UK Biobank is in turn accountable to the Ethics and Governance Council. So this was actually an incredibly complicated process that the funders tried to go through by having this in parallel development of the scientific protocol as well as some creation of an ethical framework. And one of the biggest problems that we actually faced was that the scientific protocol kept changing. And of course, the ethics and the governance can only be driven by what effectively the scientists are claiming that they want to do or asking to do. So often it necessarily had to be an iterative process between the scientists and those of us who were advising the funders as to how the ethical framework might ultimately look. And that process also involved consultations with the public, with other healthcare professionals, with experts in a number of different disciplines, in terms of trying to cover all the different bases as to what needs to be contained in this ethics and governance framework. And the way in which it was approached in the first instance was to set up an interim advisory group, which existed from 2002 to 2004, to advise the funders. And one of the recommendations was that a permanent Ethics and Governance Council should actually emerge, which is my final point there. But what was also clear in the course of this process of discussion about what should actually happen and what was necessary, it was felt that there were two key documents had to emerge. One, as I've indicated, was the Ethics and Governance Framework itself, which has to be a public document. And it's a document which is effectively owned by UK Biobank. The responsibility for the upkeep of that document is UK Biobank. It is not this Ethics and Governance Council. And secondly, the development, publication and ongoing consultation over their IP and access policy. Who's going to get access to this resource, in what circumstances, on what basis, and how will intellectual property be governed? And this framework is trying to do actually a number of things. It's very ambitious in terms of those aims. Obviously, it's trying to facilitate ethical research, and it's trying to ensure that UK Biobank is true to its purpose, which, as we'll see as I go along, is to create a health resource which promotes public good and to which they wish to promote access. They actually want to promote access to this resource. They want it to be used for health-related research. At the same time, there are obligations to respect participants' privacy and their confidentiality in their data, but also any concerns that may result in terms of the security of their tissues or their blood or their urine or whatever other material may have been donated. But as I've indicated, at the same time as that, there's this obligation to encourage and to control access in order to encourage the sharing of information that comes from this resource. And that in itself will bring new challenges in terms of different research groups wanting access to the resource, but having an obligation effectively to share more publicly their findings. And as I say, we've got this aim to establish the independent monitoring body, the Ethics and Governance Council, in an overarching facility. These next few slides try to outline the various elements of the Ethics and Governance Framework and the relationship that UK Biobank has with different audiences, different stakeholders, if you like. First and foremost, and probably most importantly, the relationship with participants. We hope to recruit 500,000 people. When they did a pilot, the uptake rate was about 10%, so you're talking about trying to actually contact 5 to 6 million people around the UK in the appropriate age range. And as I indicated earlier on, this project is run on an opt-in basis. So the Ethics and Governance Framework affirms the fact that it's the voluntary nature of the participation. This was one of the first and continues to be one of the key ethical concerns about these projects. They are long-term projects. UK Biobank and Generation Scotland are not going to reveal results for maybe 5, 10, 15, 30 years. People are in for the long haul. They want to have access to people's information until they die and possibly thereafter. And if you look at the fundamental notions that we have that kind of govern medical research at the moment, which very often focuses on consent, you need individual consent, can you really tell people what they're consenting to if you don't know what will be the purposes of the resource 20, 30 years down the line? And that's something we can explore. The basis upon which UK Biobank is set up, arguably the only basis upon which it can be set up, is the idea of broad consent. You agree to participate in Biobank, meaning with all of the consequences that entails, including this long-term commitment and including the idea that there may be access in due course. And that effectively speaks to the point there about establishing the elements of consent. There's also commitment there within the Ethics and Governance Framework to reduce barriers to participation. And what they mean by that is individuals who may already be suffering from disease, individuals who may have language barriers. There's real division between the sexes in terms of who's likely to come forward for participation. All of that is accounted for within the Ethics and Governance Framework. But fundamentally, this idea of broad consent, which, as I say, is ethically contentious, can really only hold if the Ethics and Governance Framework affirms the right to withdraw, the right to say at any point without giving any reason, I do not want anything more to do with this project and I want to walk away from it. And actually, if you look in detail with what the ethics and governance framework lays out, there's actually different options for withdrawal. You can say, just don't contact me anymore, but you can use what you've already got. Or I want you to destroy what you have in terms of samples and information. That was very interesting, because that actually, that's called the no further use provision. That created for us in the Ethics and Governance Council one of our first real challenges in terms of our relationship with UK Biobank. Because in the first version of the Ethics and Governance Framework, UK Biobank said, because they believed it to be the case at the time, that if you ask us to destroy all information about you, we will do that. But the nature of the IT systems that they've actually developed are such, with audit trails, that they actually cannot get rid of all the information that they have upon you. So they came back, which obviously may be perfectly obvious to this audience, but then Biobank brought, this is exactly the reason why the Ethics and Governance Council has a role to play. They brought that to the council and said, what should we do about this? Because the Ethics and Governance Framework seems to offer a guarantee that effectively, technically, we cannot respect. And our recommendation after debate was, well, that needs to be changed and people need to know about it. And that has been, that has happened. But that was very much down to the development of the technology and a realisation that that original expectation could not be respected in due course. But fundamentally, the point to note there is what is constant there but no further use is that they would not use the information for research purposes. It was the technical complication that they needed to be clearer upon, not that they were moving from the original guarantee to participants. And obviously, and overarchingly, from a privacy point of view, finally here, in terms of the relationship with participants, they make a commitment to protect the confidentiality both of the samples and of the data. But if this is being set up as a public resource, and if the expectation is that they want to attract researchers to use the resource, there also has to be some sort of statement about what the relationship is between UK Biobank and the research community. And effectively what the Ethics and Governance Framework does is to confirm UK Biobank's role as a steward of the resource. That's the language that is used. And in sort of quasi-legal terms, it means that they're there as a custodian of that resource to manage it for the public good. In strict technical legal terms, they own the resource, they own the databases, they own the samples. That's quite straightforward as a matter of law, but the commitment is to act much more as a custodian and to manage it towards this broader public good, and we can explore what that might mean in practice presently. And also they need to describe the principles of access. And finally, the EGF lays out the relationship with society. And therefore, it requires that there's a public and transparent description of the management of the resource, the management of UK Biobank, and accountability, lines of accountability that we've already seen between the EGC and the funders, for example. The notion that the resource will be fenced off for health-related research only, a limitation there as to who might have access to it, arguably quite broad in terms of what might come within health-related research, and again, something we can talk about in due course. I've already mentioned it establishes the Ethics and Governance Council, but another obligation, and this is one I think where potentially there's a lot of possibility for imaginative uses here, there's an obligation of benefit sharing. The idea that if this resource is to be used for the public good, then findings, for example, should be published in due course, subject perhaps to issues of intellectual property, which we'll come to. There needs to be careful management of the intellectual property itself, because we shouldn't always assume that intellectual property is an evil and is always against the public good. It's possible to manage it for the public good. And there's also an obligation there to archive data and findings for future use, to feed it back to UK Biobank, despite what your individual research project may have as its objectives. So, just to sum up at this stage, the respective responsibilities are outlined by this Ethics and Governance Framework. From the point of view of UK Biobank, it's to build this resource to support diverse research, health-related research, and to manage it for the public good. Although they are technical owners of the resource, they will act as a steward of the resource, but at the same time they're going to promote access to the resource within that broad aim, and at the same time as that still, there's an obligation to protect participants' interests. I think what that does potentially is set up a very interesting set of tensions. How are they actually going to be able to manage those potentially competing objectives within this ethics and governance framework? From the point of view of the Ethics and Governance Council, and I stress this is an independent body that's there, that sits at arm's length from UK Biobank, the EGF makes it clear that its role is to monitor and advise UKB on compliance with the EGF. But as I said earlier, the Ethics and Governance Framework is UK Biobank's document. It's their responsibility to ensure that it is as robust as possible. It's the responsibility in turn of the Ethics and Governance Council to maintain independence of thought and action in the way in which it interacts with UK Biobank. And importantly, our role is to speak about UK Biobank, not for UK Biobank. And it seems almost every time I give this talk, I say that, and then with questions, people say, yes, but what are you doing in Biobank? I said, we're not doing anything. UK Biobank are doing something, and we can comment on that, but it's really important we understand that these are two quite separate bodies. And overarchingly, from the point of view of the EGC, it's also there to protect participants' interests, but also to protect public interest and to engage members of the public in broader debates, such as hopefully we'll have this evening, about whether this resource is actually being managed to as best as it could be. What I'd like to do now is to sort of focus in on the key themes of my topic, intellectual property and privacy. And I've suggested that the way in which the ethics and governance framework has been set up may set up some tensions for UK Biobank in terms of how it can actually further these objectives. It's been established from the point of view of both UK Biobank and the Ethics and Governance Council that the development of the access and IP policy is going to be a dialogue. It's going to be an iterative process of backwards and forwards and different input in terms of what this document, what this instrument needs to address, what sort of audiences it needs to speak to. And when I took over in September 2006, I took over as the second chair of the Ethics and Governance Council. And it was a very interesting time to do that because it was just at the time when all of the preparatory material and all the preparatory sort of standard operating procedures had already been taken care of almost. Biobank was coming to the end of its setup period and it was about to launch. And as I suggested, it launched in April of last year. And I saw very quickly, and my colleagues in the EGC agreed, that one of the biggest challenges for us and for UK Biobank in this new phase after setup is actually to get the access and IP policy right. And what we've done in the EGC is set up a subgroup to look at, in some detail, what the access and IP issues actually are. The latest version is from October last year. It's under constant revision, and it's also been passed to the Board of Directors, and indeed we've invited the Secretary of the Board of Directors, who's actually an intellectual property lawyer, to come to our next meeting of the EGC in March of this year to inform us about what's been going on. But already we feel we've been able to make some suggestions to UKB about what they should be doing. What I've put down here in this slide are some of the challenges I think that they face in moving forward. This is a resource that's not just about information, it's also about samples. And therefore, parts of the resource are actually limited. Those samples are depletable. So how do you optimize the value of that resource when you're dealing with something that is not inexhaustible, unlike data? Also, what is the resource? What do we mean by the resource? Is it individual data sets? Is it the data sets together with the samples? Should these be sent out as part of the resource? Can they become a resource in their own right? Are participants a resource? Social scientists are interested in this. We want to get access to people. What do you think about your experience of taking part in these sorts of longitudinal databases? Do you feel that you were properly respected? What do you think about commercialization? I'll come back to that as one of my final points. But also in terms of developing the access and IP policy, Biobank needs to think about, well, who is the audience? Who is it for? First and foremost, it's about researchers. The researchers need to know clearly the basis upon which they should or will be able to get access to this valuable resource. But there's also the public, or members of the public, understanding that the privacy concerns that they might have related to access and who might have access, such as insurers or employers, if that was ever contemplated, is adequately provided for. So you've got a range of audiences there in terms of who needs to understand and accept and adopt this access and IP policy. And as I suggested earlier on, when we're talking about sort of broad consent, this idea that you're consenting to participate in a long-term project, we don't know how long it will go on for, we don't know how valuable the resource will be, we don't know who's going to ask for access to it. How do you manage those uncertainties? How do you set up systems so that we can at least anticipate that those uncertainties can be minimized and they can be managed to the best possible effect? Clearly, you need robust and transparent processes, but also what are the time frames involved? When do you start letting people have access to this resource? So what we did in our subgroup was to identify five core questions of the access and IP policy. Quite clearly, the first one's quite obvious there. Who should have access? But who decides it, and how do they decide it? By reference to what? How are scientific decisions going to be taken when you're dealing with the depletable resource? And again, time comes in there. They're contemplating having a role for a scientific access committee. What will that role be? But interestingly too, what is the role of an ethics council? You can't just see this as an issue of having access to science or scientific data or scientific samples when there necessarily are correlated privacy concerns. So what might the relationship there be between an access committee and an ethics council? And it's fine to say we need benefit sharing and that IP needs to be properly managed, but what specific policies or principles are going to guide the intellectual property when you get down to the nitty-gritty of giving access and doing deals in terms of commercialization? And similarly, the final question here, there is a nice commitment to benefit sharing, but what will benefit sharing actually look like and who will benefit in due course once that access is actually provided? Apologies for giving you a rather dense text here, but this is taken directly from the version that we were working on, and it indicates the core principles that inform this access and IP policy. And it points out, first and foremost, that participant privacy is of utmost importance to UK Biobank, and that any request for access to data will be subject to the most stringent security measures. So they make it clear, as far as they can, that privacy is their overarching concern. But they then go on to make the point that, well, of course, the data are not depletable, but the samples actually are. And therefore, consequently, what they're looking for is effectively two guiding principles: privacy protection, but also efficient management of the samples to ensure that greatest scientific value can be extracted from them in terms of coordinating the resource use. My question as a lawyer is, okay, nice rhetoric, what's the reality? What are you actually going to do? And this is not just directed at Biobank, but any of these bodies. What are you actually going to do to make sure that the resource is subject to the most stringent security measures? You people can talk about the technicalities of that. From a governance point of view, I would sort of point to a new initiative, well, it's new for the United Kingdom, that is being promoted by the Information Commissioner's Office. This is the idea of privacy impact assessments. They commissioned a study last year from Loughborough University to look into these exercises. And what I've put up on this slide, I'm sorry it's condensed, taken from the ICO's website, but this is now the sort of best practice that the Information Commissioner is suggesting to all bodies when they are handling personal data or when they're introducing new measures or new processes or new ways of dealing with personal data which may raise privacy concerns. And effectively the idea is that you carry out a privacy impact assessment. You carry out an assessment of exactly the nature of the threat that's there, exactly the nature of the provisions that are already in place, exactly the nature of the increased risk that may come with your new measures, exactly the nature of what it is you're going to implement to reduce those additional risks. And ultimately, as this paragraph indicates, usually a privacy impact assessment results in a privacy impact report, which may be published, sometimes subject to, you know, they're subject to commercial sensitivity, or distributed to participants and wider stakeholders. If you like, it's another example of this transparent engagement with the issues. We've not had this discussion with UK Biobank. I think it's one that we should have with them about their attitude towards these new measures in the United Kingdom. As I say, they're new here, but they're not new in other countries. They've already been well carried out and well documented in countries like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Hong Kong, in terms of carrying out this sort of exercise. But it is new for the UK, and I think there's going to be some big challenges ahead for lots of companies and organisations such as UK Biobank in terms of carrying out PIAs that are actually effective and that actually do identify where there may be increased risks. The access and IP policy goes on to talk about other principles that will guide access. We've already touched on most of these. I just want to go through this quite quickly. Once again, it keeps talking about this idea of the public good, that the resource should be managed for the public good. Nice rhetoric, but what does it mean in reality? How will that actually translate to decisions? And the answer is we don't know yet. But what it reiterates in terms of the decisions is what I said right at the outset, that of course UK Biobank has got to protect its participants and honour commitments made to them. And it's of course got to ensure compliance with all the legal and statutory regulatory mechanisms. It's going beyond what's required by law, beyond what's required by ethics, in an effort hopefully to engender and to maintain trust in the project as a whole and to ensure that participants remain committed to the project. Because of course the worst thing that could happen is that if people feel that their interests and their privacy is not being protected and they exercise that all important right to withdraw, then it's the end of a project like UK Biobank or any other. They talk about prioritising access to those parts of the resource that are limited in availability. When the samples are depletable, we don't yet have an idea about the basis upon which that will be done. And they also have the commitment to manage the intellectual property resources in ways that are effective to promote this objective of public good. But what I would sort of stress once again is overarchingly, and subject to those constraints, it is the objective of UK Biobank to provide access to the resource and to effectively promote that so that information flows widely and openly as possible to maximise its use and its value. And they say quite openly and up front that will include access from bodies which are both academic and commercial, which are both private and public sector, both in the UK and overseas. But as we know, with transfers overseas, etc., there may well be other privacy concerns invoked. Just want to say a few things about the coordination of the resource. I said that time was very important here. Tim Smosen is one of is the chief scientific officer in UK Biobank, and in his talks about the sort of timescales involved, he estimates that if you're trying to achieve 10,000 incident cases of any condition, then the timescale is actually quite different. So, for example, if you're looking about for 10,000 people to develop diabetes, that may take 10 years. If you're looking to investigate lung cancer, before you're going to get 10,000 cases, it might take 35 years. So it just reiterates this point that Biobank is a long-term project. And their position at the moment is that decisions on assays in terms of testing, etc., will be taken only when hypotheses about potential research value from any particular given research project become much clearer. There's still ongoing discussion about whether samples should actually be given away or retained within bodies such as UK Biobank or Generation Scotland. It is possible for these bodies to organise for assays to be conducted and for the results to be disclosed rather than any samples to be disclosed. And that may have to be a compromise in due course if privacy concerns are thought to be too great. But ultimately what we're going to have is a staggered timeline in access and a coordinated approach. And UK Biobank has indicated that it itself will make calls for applicants to come forward and to develop protocols when they feel that the resource is ready enough for particular calls in particular areas. That, in turn, may lead us to say, well, we don't need to be addressing these access and IP issues quite yet. And personally, I don't think that's right. I think we need to be addressing them and discussing these issues now because, as I hope I'm showing with my talk, there are much broader concerns than just the scientific access to the resource. In terms of the access process, it's been mooted that there should be an access committee and that should involve leading academics and commercial researchers. And that's really an issue about the politics of all of this and who's involved and who has some say in how this project is actually managed. But it's thought to be the case that the Access Committee has the responsibility to develop and monitor the review processes to ensure that they are transparent and they are fair to as many members of the potential research community as is possible. I mentioned earlier there may be a role here for an Ethics and Governance Council. How might that work? Well, one way that it might work is that given the fact that the Access Committee is primarily about scientific discussions, scientific decisions about who should have access for scientific reasons, an Ethics and Governance Council may be invoked if there are increased concerns about privacy. If a privacy impact assessment is carried out, if there's a proposal, for example, that these results should be linked to other results already held or to be generated by those who are having access. If there are broader privacy concerns, it may be appropriate for that access request to be referred also to the Ethics and Governance Council to consider what is the impact or the likely impact on privacy by allowing or not allowing access to the resource. And finally, there's a commitment that the Access Committee should be broadly representative of areas of research, but I think that is a debate that I would rather not be part of. If we just look coming to the end, if you look at the terms of the access as they're currently being put forward, clearly they have to comply with the Ethics and Governance Framework, and they have to comply with participants' consent. So people have agreed to allow access to the resource for health-related research. So any proposal of research that would obviously go beyond that would not be within the terms of that consent and therefore should not be allowed. And again, that's a potential role for the Ethics and Governance Council. You have to do a clear statement of the purposes of access and use, but there will be no exclusive licenses. Unlike what happened in Iceland, this sort of exclusive license to something like Roche would not happen, would not be allowed, and would not be politically acceptable. And indeed, they go further in their suggestions about how they will control access terms, that there would only be limited exclusive use to secure analyses, for example, for 6 to 12 months. And what that does, in large part, is actually link it to any potential work it might result in a patent application, as we know that you need to keep information out of the public domain before you file your patent application, otherwise it will not be granted. But that's quite a tight window in terms of giving flexibility to those who might want to have access. And moreover, even when that happens, as I've said here in brackets, the expectation of the terms will dictate that the results need also to flow back to UK Biobank. UK Biobank sees itself as being a disseminator of knowledge, another route whereby it can promote the public good. And clearly what we require are systems to monitor compliance, and interestingly, systems to deal with non-compliance. What happens if they don't respect those terms? It's technically a breach of contract. It may be an invasion of your privacy as a participant, but if it's a breach of contract, the parties to the contract are UK Biobank and those who had access. So therefore, those who can bring an action in contract are UK Biobank. Where does that leave you as a participant if you feel aggrieved that your privacy has somehow not been respected? And it's still for discussion whether or not access fees will be charged at commercial rates, or whether it would be a flat fee. Ultimately, the funders expect this to be self-sustaining, but it's not clear how in the longer term that's going to happen. There are clear commitments of non-access, and this tries to address the standard concerns that come up in this area. Will insurers have access? Will employers have access? Will the police have access? And what this makes clear is certainly not insurers or employers. But the reality is that if the police get a court warrant to have access to the resource, then UK Biobank will have to accede to that warrant. But that's exactly the same as any research study. UK Biobank is not in a special position here. And indeed, Generation Scotland goes one stage further in this respect, and they say they will actively resist any such request, which may make a difference. But at the end of the day, this is just standard application of the criminal law, but it does concern people about their privacy. What about IP? The IP position is actually really quite straightforward. Whether we agree with it in principle, again, is a matter for discussion. But as I've already said, UK Biobank is the steward of the resource. They want to manage it for the public good. And therefore, any intellectual property in UK Biobank, such as the database itself, the database is the subject of a database right, stays with UK Biobank, although they may grant royalty-free licenses to those who wish to have access to it. But any IP that is generated from UK Biobank, for example, those who have access, will actually go with the creator. So there isn't any attempt to use what we call reach-through royalties or reach-through provisions, partly because it's felt that that would be unnecessarily complicated and not necessarily within the spirit of managing it for the public good. What we suggested to them, these were the two lawyers on the on our subgroup, you might want to insert the word normally there. Normally, the IP from UK Biobank would go to the creator, because you might want, in some circumstances, to vary those terms. But UKB does say that it can step in if intellectual property has been generated, but it's not actually being exploited within a reasonable time. And that's a sort of almost, not, it's not quite a form of, it's not a compulsory license, but it is a form of trying to maintain control so that the information is used and is disseminated and is actually out there in the public domain. And finally, in terms of benefit sharing, I suggested to you that this is one area where there could be, we all could be quite imaginative in terms of what does benefit sharing mean, who might benefit, etc. The position at the end of the day is quite straightforward at the moment, that users have an obligation to disseminate the results widely and as rapidly as possible, subject to caveats, for example, if you're applying for a patent. They're encouraged to share their findings and data as openly as possible. But I think the most interesting and potentially the most difficult challenge in the future is the obligation to feed results back to UK Biobank, but even including negative findings, so that certain areas of research which show that there's not a correlation between X and Y is out there in the public domain. But you can imagine that giving rise to tension among researchers who don't want to have spent 5 years or be seen to have spent 5 years on their work, effectively to say, well, we came up with a non-answer. Of course, it is a valuable answer from the public perspective, but it may not do their reputation any good. So, in conclusion, what would I say? This is an ongoing process. I would suggest, and I'd be interested to hear your views, I think there are some sound principles in place here in terms of how we deal with these issues of property and privacy. The devil is always going to be in the detail. That's going to emerge in due course, hopefully. The processes themselves of dealing with this, of transparency, of robustness, are emerging, but the roles of bodies such as an access committee or an ethics and governance council remain unclear. And time, I think, is important. I said earlier that we may feel, because this resource is not going to reveal much anytime soon, we've got time to deal with this. I would dispute that. I think we need to be having this conversation now. two associated issues which bring it back to publics. Should there be access to participants? Should you be able to have access to participants either in terms of having, you know, carrying out new studies because you've got the information there, or even in access in terms of queries? That, I think, is a difficult one. And that's one that they're going to face up, and it's not currently addressed in the access policy. And the final thing I would say, and this links to my own research that I've been doing with colleagues in social science in Edinburgh, these colleagues do public attitude surveys, and some of these surveys have shown that in some quarters there's really quite significant concern about commercialization. And it may be so extreme, this is not about Biobank, this is broader issues about genetic research, but it may be so extreme that it might actually stop people participating in the research. So I think there for us is, you know, what are the policy options to stop that happening? Do you say quite bluntly commercialization shouldn't happen? I think that's naive and it's not realistic. But if you don't say something like that, how do you address these public concerns? Because fundamentally, as I said right at the beginning, if the public's not on board, these projects are not going to work. The way in which the Ethics and Governance Council actually approaches ethics is effectively, I think, quite a non-academic way. It doesn't try to sort of put it into academic terms. It tries to basically say that there are ethical issues in almost every single action, if not every single action that we're involved in. And what our role is to actually weigh up what are the sets of interests in play, and what are the tensions, what are the possible options, and how can we best advise the way forward. So in that sense, anybody who has an opinion on what should happen can be seen as informed about ethics, certainly. But in terms of the way in which they set it up, they put two professors of ethics on the interim advisory board.
They were philosophers.
They were philosophers, yeah. What are the privacy rights or interests of family members is a really good one. And when we construct privacy rights in Europe, and in fact almost every country, is very much about an individualistic notion. It's your information, it's your privacy, and therefore it's your right to control it. Yeah? And there's hardly any examples in courts or in law of recognizing effectively what you're pointing to, which are the incredibly complicated relationships, the fact that it can be your information and his information at the same time. Now, but I think that's changing. We've got maybe two examples of it changing. The first one was the Icelandic example. I told you that law they passed was declared unconstitutional. Yeah, the reason it was declared unconstitutional was because a woman objected to her father's information being added to the database, and she was able to convince the Supreme Court in Iceland that in some sense was actually her information, or at least it had enough of an effect on her that it impacted on her privacy interests, and it was not lawful for them to do that, and they accepted that. That's one example. The second example is we've got something in Europe called the Article 29 Working Group on Data Protection. Sexy title. It's their job to advise all of the countries around Europe on how do we complicated laws about data protection. And they have said, we recognise these complex relationships, but we're not sure how to deal with it in law. But what we might say is that we can at least say there are other people's interests in play, and therefore you need to build systems that recognise those sensitivities. Yeah? Which may well be technical systems as opposed to systems of law. Because as I indicated, the law is actually not sophisticated enough to take account of that. But I think the attitude is changing, and it's actually through these examples and through genetics that we're beginning to realise that you can't isolate any of us and say it's just your privacy. It's never just your privacy. And government. Okay. Oh gosh, big question. Can I give you an example of something else I was involved in recently, which is related to this? There's a body called the Nuffield Council on Bioethics, and it looks at the ethical issues related to medicine. And it's got a particular interest in genetics. And they set up a working group recently to look at forensic uses of bioinformation, and in particular, the uses of the National DNA Database. As you know, we have the biggest in the world. It's doubled its size in the last 3 years. And there's been examples in law of what I think you're hinting at, which is effectively sort of function creep. It used to be the case you could only go on it if you were convicted. Then it was the case you go on it if you were charged. Now it's the case in England and Wales you can go on it if you're arrested. So what this body was doing was looking at the situation and saying, how do you control government? What, you know, is there evidence of this sort of thing? We suggested in that report that there is. And one of our recommendations was to say, in that context of criminal matters, arguably where it matters the most, there has not been transparent and robust governance. And it's all been carried out within the Home Office or within branches of the Home Office, and there hasn't been independent oversight. It's only now, after many, many decades, they're appointing a regulator. So one of our recommendations was you applied also to government and not just in the context of these sort of projects. Which I wish they'd ask me is why do you take part? And the answer is no, because I'm too young. Only for another 2 months, but nobody's asked me that question. Being serious for a second, that is one of the most contentious issues, and it comes down to a number of different factors. The scientific factor is they are carrying out a scientific project to create generalizable knowledge, and therefore it's highly unlikely, although not impossible, it's highly unlikely given the types of studies that are going to be carried out, when actually they're looking at the aggregate data, they're not looking at individuals, that it's actually going to reveal something specific about any one individual. And to the extent that it does begin to indicate that something should be happening within the health system, well, there should be enough mechanisms whereby that information is filtering across from the research system to the health system and should be filtering down appropriately, and you're being contacted by people who can actually perhaps counsel you or, you know, or direct you appropriately, rather than it coming from a research community. Secondly, there's the privacy issues as well. If it was possible, or if there was a suggestion that it should be possible to sort of trace back individuals, you know, from anything that their sample might reveal about them, then necessarily it increases the privacy risks and increases the number of individuals who have to have access to that in order to carry out what is, it seems, in most circumstances, a highly unlikely link that would arise. And the third point, which is a very pragmatic point, is this is research, it's not healthcare, and the costs involved to do that would probably make something like Biobank unworkable. What I would sort of stress, though, is that they do offer you feedback at the assessment centre. You know, so if it transpires that you have high blood pressure, or there's somebody sort of spots a mole in your neck, the nurse thinks that looks somewhat suspicious, they do have protocols whereby they will advise you. They will give you a readout of your body mass index, your blood pressure, and other sort of standard measurements. And if it's beyond what's a normal range, the suggestion is you should go and see your GP. And also, sorry, but being a lawyer about it, the reliability issues for them as well. If they put themselves in a position whereby effectively they're assuming a clinical role, then they will be held by the law to have to offer that standard of care. And they're not in a position to offer that standard of care. They're in a position of researcher and participant. There's still a duty of care to them, but the standard that's required is different. I'm sorry, that's a very legalistic answer, but that's another factor that they have to consider. It would, if you could get access to information you anyway, it would be under data protection, because you've got access rights anyway. Freedom of information is about public authorities that hold public sector information, and this is a company limited by guarantee, so that legislation would apply to them. But you might try under, you know, access provisions for data protection. But again, I suspect that their legitimate answer within the data protection law would be, we've already built in all these protection measures that we cannot, or only a few people can actually trace what might have actually happened to your information. So we can, and therefore what's held about you that's identifiable will be the very, very initial stage work. And what they try to do in order to protect your information is to break the link with identifiability as soon as possible, so that your privacy is protected as far as possible. Under data protection legislation, if somebody is illegally processing personal data, meaning data from which you can be identified, there are remedies that you can bring. There's also, under human rights legislation, you have the right to life, and that can only be departed from with good reason when it's necessary and proportionate. And if they're doing it sort of against an agreement with Biobank, that again possibly could give rise to remedies. The question, I think the more interesting question is, what would you actually get in terms of damages? You know, you go there, you see, yes, technically there may be a breach, but Britain does not have a strong legal tradition of protecting privacy. We've got protection because we have to have it under our obligations of European law. That's quite specific. We've never had a broad right to privacy. We've got a right to respect for private life because we now have the Human Rights Act, but that doesn't necessarily encompass all aspects of your private life. We don't have that tradition. We've actually gone to court, and even if they're successful in the argument, my question is, well, what are you likely to get for it? It may just be nominal damages. Yes, we recognise economic harm, for example, that flowed from it. But you're very much.
Just to follow up on that, you pointed out that for good ethical reasons, it's an opt-in system.
Hmm. Yes, absolutely. And it's linked to something that somebody was saying earlier on about whether you were healthy or not. why they keep revise their target areas when they come to new cities. What they're already seeing, both UK Biobank and Generation Scotland, is that women are far more likely to come forward than men, and they don't want to. They don't obviously don't want to skew the statistical relevance of their resource, so they keep having to change it exactly because of that reason. Absolutely. And likewise, if you want to, and this even within men, young men are less likely to volunteer than older men. So Generation Scotland, which doesn't have this older, is facing an issue. People from certain socioeconomic backgrounds, where arguably there's more likelihood of certain types of ill health, are not coming forward as quickly as the middle classes. So if you compare how well UK Biobank to Edinburgh, well, you can imagine which one is the most successful recruitment centre. You're absolutely right. Because the funding is coming from the Wellcome Trust, you know, the richest medical charity in the world, and the MRC, which is government funded. But so in that sense, I think they would be shooting themselves because the economic argument simply isn't there. You could make that argument in the context of Generation Scotland, because that money is coming primarily from the Chief Scientist's Office. But again, you know, we've got plenty of examples in the UK we can point to where there has been undermining of public trust, there has been appalling governance. Anybody with half a brain would see that there's, you know, good arguments for the science. So there's always going to be that economic pressure. But so long as these sorts of mechanisms can be seen to deliver, then arguably, you know, the funds will be allocated appropriately. The next question, obviously, is, well, are we delivering? From the viewer's point of view, all the figures there for the EGC, you know, are public, and it's more than adequate for what we're doing at the moment. In terms of these first few years of our operation, what we have been doing is looking at what procedures do we think we need to be effective. So communication procedures, you know, openness and access to the information, regular reporting. If people are complaining about UK Biobank, you know, are they telling us that they're complaining? What are they complaining about? How are they categorising those complaints? Is it an ethical complaint? What does that mean? All of those slightly tedious dialogues we've been having with them, so that we can, and from that we've been laying out where we see. You're right. I mean, the resource issue aside, you know, if those frameworks aren't there, it's not going to work. It's not a regulatory body. It's an advisory and monitoring body. But what we've done with UK Biobank is sign a memorandum of understanding, but clear lines of communication. We've agreed what we think are appropriate reporting mechanisms at the moment, which allow escalation from within their organisation if we're not happy, and ultimately to the funders if we're not happy. But it's to do that would actually cast a slightly different role. It's not set up by statute, it's set up by the funders on a voluntary basis. The objective of the funders responding to some concerns and responding to the need to sort of manage this incredibly ambitious project effectively is working. I think if you want to bring in, well, we don't need to bring in inspectorates, because as I've said already, they're subject to all the existing ethical and legal restraints. You know, so in terms of anything that they'll be carrying out in their labs or all the, you know, anything technical like that, there already are mechanisms. And again, being a lawyer, it sounds odd, but surely we don't need more regulatory mechanisms like that. This is a hands-off approach on top of all of that. I've not seen any evidence to suggest that we would want to come in any heavier. Visited their facilities. We've asked their come and report to us. We've, you know, asked exactly that question. What is it? What mechanisms do you have in place? Apparently, they've got a group or groups that regularly try to break into their systems in order to test their IT. They tell us, and we believe them, that they've so far never broken. One of our discussions in terms of the constitution of our group, we think in due course, when we come to reappoint individuals, which will be later this year, we would actually like an IT technical specialist. We have people who have sort of scientific background, legal, ethical, etc., but somebody with the ability to sort of ask exactly those questions and understand specifically the answers, I think would be of added value to the group, definitely.